Hello, and welcome to episode one of this three-episode Hemophilia and Young Adulthood podcast series presented by Bloodstream Stories. I'm Bloodstream Media founder and host Patrick James Lynch. In early 2018, Bloodstream partnered with the Hemophilia Association of New Jersey to produce a roundtable conversation made up of men between the ages of 18 and 35 living with hemophilia, and their champion, an advocate, so to speak. Chapter Executive Director Stephanie Lapido brought together a group of men with different backgrounds, stories, different experiences with hemophilia, and different champions with their own unique points of view. My wife and Bloodstream podcast co-host Natalie Lynch served as my champion and co-facilitator of the conversation alongside me. We wanted to bring it back because a lot of really great stuff was discussed during that event. And just on the May 2019 episode of the Bloodstream podcast, episode 36, for those of you keeping track at home, we again found ourselves addressing some of the unique considerations and challenges facing young men with hemophilia. So we decided it was time to bring this series and this discussion back to you. The episodes are short, 2 30-minuters with a 20-minute conclusion, and I think you're going to find the open and honest stories, experiences, and points of view shared to be quite valuable. Since some time has passed, since we first released the content, a few small things have changed that you might pick up on, including the name of the program's original sponsor, Shire, is now part of Takeda, in case you hadn't heard, and we thank them for supporting this project. For those listening in real time, this is episode 1. Episode 2 goes live July 8th, and episode 3 on July 22nd. The second and third episodes broken up, of course, by our traditional flagship episode of the Bloodstream podcast. I mention all that now to spare you an outro message with that need-to-know information. So July 8th, episode 2, July 15th, the Bloodstream podcast, episode 38, July 22nd, episode 3. Ta-da! So thanks for listening, and now please enjoy episode 1 of Hemophilia and Young Adulthood, brought to you by Bloodstream Stories. Hello, and welcome to this special Bloodline podcast series, a young adult roundtable discussion on hemophilia, brought to you by Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited. Alongside my champion and your co-host, Natalie Lynch. Say hello, Natalie.
Hello, Natalie.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Say hello to the listeners.
Hello, podcast listeners.
That's more like it. Alongside my champion, co-host Natalie Lynch, I'm Patrick James Lynch, and we are very excited to present Bloodstream Media's first roundtable discussion recorded live earlier this year at the Madison Hotel in Morristown, New Jersey, with members of the HANJ community. We will bring you this conversation in three parts, this episode, of course, being part one, with each part centered around a few topics of importance specifically to young adult men with hemophilia. And Natalie, I think it's fair to say that we identified a few themes as we dove into our various topics.
That's absolutely fair to say. And I should mention, these topics include the need for emotional support, pushing physical limits, pain management and substance abuse, dating and intimacy, and more.
To share their stories and perspectives, we brought together 4 adult men with hemophilia ranging in age from 18 to 34, one young man in high school, one in college, and 2 young professionals, 4 different ethnic backgrounds, one guy who was born in South America, one the son of immigrants, some with family history, some without, mild, moderate, and severe forms of hemophilia. So really a broad range of life experiences to draw from for this in-depth conversation.
We also asked each of our 4 young men to bring a champion.
Natalie, how are we defining champion?
A champion is a person who's helped them with their hemophilia in one way or another. Our 2 young professionals were joined by their wives, which as a hemo wife myself, I certainly appreciate it. And 1 young man was joined by his mother,
who also raised a couple of other boys with hemophilia.
She did. So she was able to share as a parent of a few men with hemophilia. And 1 participant chose HANJ's executive director, Stephanie Lapido, as his champion, which was cool since she was able to wear the champion of Justin hat as well as the executive director hat.
In part 1, we feature the beginning of the discussion, which centered around 3 themes. Identity as someone with a bleeding disorder, disclosure in school, professional and social settings, and transitions such as those from high school to college, from college into the professional world, and from singledom to marriage. I think you are really going to enjoy this open and honest discussion.
Patrick, just before we jump in, you mentioned at the top of this first of its kind series that it was made possible by Shire.
I did.
And let's just take a minute for a few words about connecting with Shire online. life with a bleeding disorder can be challenging. That's why Shire created the Bleeding Disorders Community Facebook page. The Bleeding Disorders Community Facebook page provides useful information and an encouraging community for people living with or caring for someone who has a bleeding disorder. Visit facebook.com/bleeding disorders community today to connect with others and help take control of your bleeding disorder.
Thank you, Natalie. And thank you, Shire, for supporting this podcast series to further education, increase empowerment, and reduce isolation of people with hemophilia and other inherited bleeding disorders. Okay, let's get into the Young Adult Roundtable featuring members of the HA&J community. And Natalie and I will be back at the end of this episode with some final thoughts and a preview of part two. Enjoy. Welcome, everybody, to Bloodstream Media's first Young Adult Roundtable Conversation. Good evening. Welcome. It's good to see you all here. Thank you to those who are here to observe as well. My name is Patrick James Lynch. I am one of the two hosts for tonight alongside...
I'm Natalie Lynch. I'm Patrick's wife and co-host.
Just to get started so that everybody can hear, everyone who's listening can hear people's voices and start to piece together what voice belongs to what name, we'll do a quick whip around. And if you can state your name, hi, my name is, and first name is fine, your diagnosis, and maybe your favorite animal. So, Natalie, you want to demonstrate? Go first, okay. Natalie. Say hello to everyone.
Hello. My name is Natalie Lynch. I am the wife of Patrick Lynch, and my favorite animal is a dolphin.
I could have guessed that.
Yeah.
I could have guessed that.
I mean, they'd be sad if you couldn't.
That's true. Yeah, I am supposed to know you rather well at this point. Who do we have next?
Good evening. My name is Juan Moreno. I'm a hemophiliac, type A, moderate. I really appreciate the fact that you guys invited me in for this today. It's my first time being podcast ever in front of a camera in a setting such as this. My favorite animal will be a dog. I do have a little parrot at home. His name is JJ, and I love that bird to death.
So dogs and JJ the bird.
Good evening. My name is Yamada. I'm Juan's wife. My favorite animal is actually JJ.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Raj. I have hemophilia A, and my favorite animal, it's to toss it between a lion and a great white shark.
We've gone far from dogs and parrots. Yeah.
What a new realm of animals.
Okay.
I'm Alyssa. I'm Raj's wife. My favorite animal is a turtle.
Hi, I'm Janet. I am Isaiah's mom. I'm the mother of three hemophiliacs. Isaiah is the middle one. And my favorite animal is a tiger.
Hi, my name is Isaiah. I have moderate hemophilia A. My favorite animal would probably be like large birds. Not sure what kind, but I like birds.
Large birds, though, not like, say, JJ.
He's fine.
He hasn't met him yet, you know.
That's fair. That's fair.
My name is Stephanie. I'm with the Hemophilia Association of New Jersey, the executive director, here supporting Justin happily.
My favorite animal is, for sure, my dog, Oliver Bernard. He's so cute, and he loves me so much that he tore up a box of tissues right before I came to come here. So he's just such a cute little guy.
Shows his love in interesting ways.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Justin Njimian. I have mild hemophilia A, and I would say my favorite animal would be a goldfish.
Nice. And I'm Patrick. I have severe hemophilia A, and my favorite animal would also be a dog. So we've got a whole list of topics to get into. So let's get started with our first topic, which is identity and community. So everyone's experience of hemophilia is different. It's individual, but it is a part of all of our identities. And while we often hear the slogan, hemophilia doesn't define me, it certainly is an inextricable part of all of our lives. So to start this topic off on how has hemophilia impacted your identity, I'd like to toss a question over to Justin. Justin, you have mild hemophilia, and in the questionnaire that was circulated ahead of today, you articulated some very thoughtful viewpoints on the identity that you have as someone with mild hemophilia. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah. So I have mild hemophilia, and you don't generally tend to hear about mild hemophilia too much in like the hemophilia community, because as it is in most cases, they're diagnosed later in life because there's not many bleeding problems apparent at birth. However, for me, it was very apparent at birth. I behave more like a moderate as opposed to a mild. That reason is unknown. There's no diagnosis for that as of yet. They do suspect a connective tissue disorder. I actually have a cousin, and since hemophilia is genetic, we do have the exact same level of factor in our blood, but he has only received 2 infusions in his life. One was prophylactic, one was for a surgery, and I have received well over around 150 to 200 infusions. I get around 6 bleeds a year. He has had no bleeds, and I was like messaging him on Facebook one day, and he just doesn't identify with his hemophilia. And it took me a while to figure out why he couldn't, because my entire life I've identified it so strongly because it's all I've ever known from birth. But I realized that he didn't really have much reason to identify with hemophilia if it wasn't truly a part of his life so much as it was mine. So it's all about having that connection and kind of knowing that there are others out there like you, because living with his type of mild hemophilia, he really didn't feel the need to reach out to anybody or seek community because he didn't really feel that he was a part of it.
Do you see that as problematic in any way? And if so, how?
I can see it as problematic because if there is an event where something serious would happen to him, he might not feel it was maybe super necessary to receive an infusion. So I feel like it's important that mild hemophiliacs know what's out there and that something can happen to them. I know, like, especially like in the teenage years, you can feel invincible. And especially if you don't identify with hemophilia that much, that can be very potentially dangerous.
Yes, I've shared this before, but it's appropriate now as well. You know, my brother unfortunately passed away in college, and I've always, not always, but as I got curious about, we grew up in the same house, same diagnosis, same doctor, same mom, like what was the difference? And I boiled it down to he never identified as having hemophilia. He wasn't active. He did bleed less, despite us both being severe. So for me, it was that piece, that identity, that he didn't identify with it. Raj, you kind of have an interesting, well, I would imagine you have an interesting perspective on this topic, given that, what, until the age of 14, you were not diagnosed. So when you think about the role of hemophilia in your identity as a man and human in this world, what does it mean to you, and how did it change after you found out, oh, I have hemophilia?
So coming into, you know, my teenage years, it was kind of difficult to accept not having the support community that others receive, I guess, would be a big part of how comfortable I would feel identifying myself as someone with hemophilia, or even sharing that I have it with even family, my relatives. It was just a complete shock type of thing. It was, you know, still something that I still have a hard time dealing with today. So I'm 29 today, and it's still an ongoing part of my life. Still having to identify with my hemophilia.
When you say hard, what does that look like? What does that mean today?
I guess just being, I guess, more understanding of how hemophilia affects my day-to-day life. Because until the age of 14, I was very active. I was getting hurt. I had nosebleeds and cuts and things that were ongoing that, like, no one was like, oh, isn't it weird that you don't stop bleeding? Like, nobody really asked that question.
Oh, that so. Raj, he's just a bleeder.
Yeah, he's just, like, constantly bleeding. And it's like, or his bruises just look, they look like he's been, like, attacked or something. And
Did you ask that question to yourself under 14? Did you have that wherewithal to say, like, I feel this is different than what other people are experiencing?
I did. I just wish I had more support at that age. So it wasn't until maybe about 2011 till after college that I actually started identifying that I had hemophilia and started feeling a little bit more comfortable sharing the fact that I had something that was very unique and something that I needed to take care of. And part of this community, I started reaching out. I think it's going to be going on about 3 years. So I'm fairly new to this community as well. So with that being said, I'm still kind of still identifying myself and where do I fit in, you know, hearing everyone's stories and just interacting with others.
Janet, so directing this question not to Isaiah, but to Mom, you mentioned that Isaiah is one of 3 boys with hemophilia. I want to ask Mom, how did you go about creating an environment where it was easy for your son? And maybe it wasn't easy, maybe I'm projecting, but how did you create an environment that gave your son the supportive structure that he needed to make identifying as someone with hemophilia as easy as possible?
Well, I guess because I was comfortable with it and I have a family history, and so I knew to expect the possibility when Isaiah was born and his brothers were born. We got tested early on because I was ready, and it was just already a part of my life. As a child, it was a part of my life growing up with my dad and my uncles, even though I didn't understand it as well then. But it was always around my whole life, so I didn't think it was anything to panic about. It was just, this is a part of your family, you know? And so Isaiah was taught about it as he got older, just like that. This is a part of who you are. It's always gonna be around. This is who our family is. And you can try to do just about what you want to do. You just need to be treated. And as he got older, he understood and grasped that idea. And I think maybe he didn't want to be very daring because of it. He had the knowledge that, you know, he was a hemophiliac, but his other older brother was very daring. He's very different, and his younger brother's very different too. Isaiah's very much an individual among the three hemophiliacs in my family. Just like if you have a family with three boys, then they don't have any medical conditions, so right. Their personalities outweighed the hemophilia, I think.
And Isaiah, do you think growing up in a family where there was a family history and you had siblings that were sharing a diagnosis, do you think that that positively impacted your ability to identify with hemophilia or negatively?
For me, it was positive because having siblings with hemophilia made it normal. Like, within my family, it was like hemophilia wasn't like a disease or a condition. It was just, you know, part of who I am. So it was like having, because two of my three brothers have it, so it's like the one brother who didn't have it was kind of like the odd one out.
Right. Did your brother ever get jealous that he's not a part of the H Club or anything?
He
did.
Yeah?
You may not know it, but he did.
You hear about that, you know, the unaffected sibling, or if there's more than one and there's only one unaffected sibling, that they wind up feeling like they're the abnormal one.
Yes.
Which is a nice little
flip. Out. They felt left out.
This special young adult roundtable discussion and Bloodline podcast series is only possible due to support from Shire. So allow me a moment to share with you about bleedingdisorders.com. Shire's website, bleedingdisorders.com, offers resources and support designed for people living with a bleeding disorder. You'll find everything from information on sports and exercises to tips on finding a local hemophilia treatment center while away at school, as well as Shire's programs and services for the bleeding disorders community. Visit bleedingdisorders.com today to find useful tools and resources. That's bleedingdisorders.com. Thank you, Shire. And now, back to our discussion.
Well, so it being normal in your family, in that micro community, it wasn't anything you had to disclose because your grandfathers, your uncles, your brothers had it. But when you go into the broader community, disclosure is a thing. There, you have something that most people do not. Keeping the focus on you, Isaiah, you had said in the questionnaire that in high school, you had gym teachers who didn't allow you to participate in things outside of gentle aerobics. And then there was classmates who you felt uncomfortable having to explain that to. Can you elaborate on that a little bit and what disclosure looked like in the school setting?
Okay. So before high school, I didn't really talk about it that much because growing up in elementary school, we played, you know, non-contact sports, maybe sports with the foam balls. So there was no real reason to talk about having hemophilia because I was able to do everything like everyone else. But in high school, you know, teenagers can get more physical when playing sports. So they said no physical sports, no contact sports. So just stick with aerobics and weightlifting. And then I had classmates ask me, like, why am I not playing sports? And I had to try to tell them. But it was kind of hard for me to figure out how to explain it because I hadn't really had much experience talking about it before. So I would just say maybe I just have, like, a condition or maybe I get hurt easily or something. Then they sort of jump to conclusions. Like, you're a bleeder, if you get hurt, you're going to bleed to death or some wild conclusions like that, which makes things even more complicated because now I have to tell them, like, that's not what it is at all.
And then you had said that when you transitioned to college, that explanation got easier. Did it get easier because you just had more experience in sharing it, or were there less questions actually asked?
It was more or less questions asked because in college, you have control, like, we have control over what activities we do. So there wasn't any real restrictions. So I can pick and choose things that I feel are safe for me.
No gym teacher saying, go over in the corner and, you know, do some jumping jacks.
Yeah.
If you were starting high school again, would you do anything differently in terms of how you spoke with gym teachers about what you were able to do and not able to do?
Yeah, I would try to sort of explain it because not all the time the gym teachers might understand what hemophilia is. They may be under the impression that any injury could be, like, you know, like life-threatening or something. That might be the reason why they say I can't go through any sports.
Right.
So I might be able to explain to gym teachers, which will allow me to participate more.
Right, right.
Yeah, okay. And misconceptions and disclosures about also educating. So, you know, there's school and then work. I would love to toss it over to Juan. In the questionnaire, you had said that you have to explain consistent unexpected bleeds to your managers, to your crazy
manager. Yeah, let's get the adjective in there.
What does that look like?
Fortunately, I've loved all my managers. I haven't had that many. I've been in maybe two different industries within the last 10 years. So I have to say, I describe them as crazy because they're phenomenal people. But just as I was growing up, I always felt embarrassed about talking about hemophilia, having to explain what it is. A lot of people would ask me questions, embarrassing questions, and I would definitely be the person on the bench at the gym class trying to avoid any sort of activity. But going back to the question, having to explain that I have hemophilia, that I have a bleed, it was hard for them to understand what it was. So I kind of had to get some sort of documentation from my doctors and explain to my managers what it is, disclose that information.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know from both you and Raj, how have you thought about, in your professional life, when to bring up that I have this condition? Do I do it at an interview stage with an HR person? Do I try to avoid it? Is it going to come up later? Am I going to flag and they're going to find a way to get rid of me? How have you navigated some of that stuff?
Today I work for a big company. I do talent advising and I'm in the HR world, so I'm the HR person.
So you're on the other side of it.
Yes, yeah. I'm on the other side where at least the company that I work for doesn't discriminate, and there's many companies like that, but I do get those questions. And I was at a Blood Brother event where a topic was discussed where, you know, do you think people with hemophilia are discriminated or, you know, based off of identifying as a disability? And the answer is no. So although
Is that your point of view, or was that kind of the consensus at that meeting that the answer was no?
It's both.
Both, okay.
It should be both. I do identify, and I do let certain individuals know that have to know. I mean, I work in a very large organization that has 128,000 employees worldwide, so it's not like I have to tell everybody.
That would be quite a task.
Yeah. It's tough because people used to ask me, well, how do you approach your manager? How do you let them know that you have something?
Right.
And when do you do it is actually the really important question.
Yes.
Do you do it at the interview? Do you do it post-interview? Do you do it on day one?
So someone on the HR side, what do you think? Because it does come up a lot.
Do you wait 3 months after you're cleared because you're in your probationary period for most companies? The answer to that question is you have to feel it out on your end where you feel it's appropriate. You might come across individuals that don't understand hemophilia. Like you said, like the gym teacher may not understand it. So you're going to have that explanation of what it is. My recommendation, it's when you feel comfortable, and that should be after, like, your first day for most people. Just to let them know, just in the event that, you know, you have to be out of work, this is why.
Right.
And you have medical documentation. And even if they still don't understand, you can say, well, I can reach out to someone from my community, and they can speak to you about it.
Right.
If you don't feel comfortable talking to me about it.
When I first got my first job working at a warehouse, involved a lot of physical lifting and so forth. One time I pulled my groin muscle, and being a hemophiliac, obviously there was some sort of bleeding involved, and I didn't infuse myself. At the time, I was actually not infusing myself at all. I didn't have knowledge of me being able to infuse myself. Once I injured myself, described my managers, I said, can I go home? He didn't really let me go. He didn't really know that I had hemophilia. I was maybe 16 years old at that time. And that's around the time that I was really embarrassed to disclose my information. Just hearing Isaiah talking about gym class, I remember the one time when I first came to this country, I'm from Colombia, I went to gym class. It was completely different from what I am used to back in my country. Gym class for us was more of a freedom type of setting. You could do whatever you want. You could go to the cafeteria and have a soda if you like.
During gym class?
Yeah.
I want to go to gym in Colombia.
Yeah. Colombian gym is interesting.
But here, when I first came, the first thing that you notice is a locker room, showers, and a basketball court. And I was like, wow, I just like the movies. You know, this is great. I'm going to be able to play with Jim Carrey or something like that. And
you must have been so disappointed.
So once I got there, I noticed the teacher. He was really strict. He said, all right, everybody get down on your arms. Let's start doing some push-ups. And I'm like, holy Jesus, I'm going to have a bleed today. I try to speak to him. My language was a barrier really bad at the time. So I try my best. I try to eliminate some force in my elbow, which is my target joint. Eventually, I had some bleeds, got home. My mom took me to the hospital, got some factor VIII. That's when I started get more familiarized with what my condition was. And, you know, that's it.
We should actually transition now to talk about transitions. You like that? You like what I did? It was kind of clever, right?
Don't laugh at him.
It's too late. I already heard Stephanie's and it's recorded for forever. So lead us through this part, Natalie.
So transitions. We'll toss this to Justin. You are a senior in high school, heading to college, I presume.
Yes.
And that is a huge transition. So what considerations do you have in regards to having hemophilia, looking forward at that transition?
Well, I'm definitely going to have to prepare myself for a lot of discussions with people like in the healthcare administration at my specific university. Right now, I'm in a very comfortable spot. I've had a 504 plan since like first grade. There hasn't been much changes in that. That's been very static. I've had the same accommodations throughout basically my entire life in my public school system. The nurses have always been very caring. They understand everything. They're very compassionate. I've never actually had any issues with gym teachers. They've always let me sit out whenever I need to. I've been very fortunate that my specific school system has been extremely accommodating, and I haven't really had to have any arguments or confrontations in that sense. And when I go to university, that may be different. I don't know if they've had a student with hemophilia before, so I'm going to have to take those challenges on for myself and hope that they'll be able to see hemophilia in the same way that my public school system has.
And Stephanie, as Justin's champion, what are maybe some additional considerations that he and all incoming freshmen should be thinking about with regard to their hemophilia in college, especially if they're going away?
Right. I think that it's important to not forget about your hemophilia, even though it may not be cool. I think that sometimes all of us, whether we have hemophilia or not, it's like we want to fit in. And, mm-hmm. you know, college is that time where you're starting to explore who you are. And there's aspects of you that you're going to experiment with things. And I just think that it would be important. And Justin knows he could call me or anybody at HANJ whenever he needs advice for anything. But my advice for any incoming college freshman would be just hold true to who you are, and hemophilia is who you are, and not to forget that or let it kind of go to the wayside just to fit into certain situations, or if you're having a bad day or if exams are getting stressful, you know, just stay the course as much as you can and lean on those champions in your life in those moments where you might feel a little vulnerable to pressures or mm-hmm. things of that nature.
Isaiah, having recently kind of gone through that transition yourself, is there anything that you learned while in college that might be useful for someone like Justin who's got that ahead of them?
My transition was relatively easy because I chose to go to a school that was nearby. And so I was still able to have access to, you know, my mom and the treatment center because they were like in nearby cities. But as far as the college, they were kind of lax. Like they said, yeah, I can bring a refrigerator to keep my factor in my dorm room.
Okay, so when you say lax, sounds accommodating to me, like lax in a good way.
Yeah, okay. But also now that I think about it, it's like, would they know what to, like they've just said, sure, go ahead, keep a factor in your room. But it was like, would they really know what to do if there was an emergency?
Oh, they were like, do whatever you need to do for this condition, that's fine, but no assistance or support was felt.
Yeah, but I was lucky to be close enough to where I could still contact my mom or my treatment center if something did happen.
Yeah, so that to me that speaks to having a plan, whether it's, you know, whether you feel like the support system that's on campus, so to speak, is strong or not. As long as you have your plan, then there are ways to cope with the challenge of perhaps a somewhat lax medical center on campus. Just a little bit of a scary thing to say out loud. That concludes part one of our Young Adult Roundtable on hemophilia. Thank you to the young adult men and their champions for their participation. And Natalie, as I think ahead to part two, which we're going to preview here in a moment with a pretty compelling soundbite, I found it interesting how much the theme of identity continually popped up as a really foundational part of hemophilia for these young men.
It did, and that's true beyond just part one. Listeners will hear that theme come up again and again in part two. We get into discussions about pushing limits, emotional support, and pain management and substance abuse.
And here is that quick snippet of part two featuring Stephanie from HA&J on the topic of addictions. Let's give it a listen.
There is a huge problem nationwide with opioids and this concept. I think sometimes people think, well, I don't have addiction in my family, so I'm in a little bit of pain and the doctor prescribed me this, I should be fine. And it's actually those folks that you're seeing are actually going down that road and they're like, I don't know how I got here. So I think having discussions, having people that you can call, and I could say at HA&J, we have gotten phone calls from folks that even though they had a support system, or it looks on the outside like they have a support system, they felt alone in certain moments, and we happen to be the people that they called.
More from our participants on that topic and many others in part two of the Bloodline podcast series featuring a young adult roundtable discussion on hemophilia, a first of its kind digital resource made possible by Shire. Life with a bleeding disorder can be challenging. That's why Shire created the Bleeding Disorders Community Facebook page. The Bleeding Disorders Community Facebook page provides useful information and an encouraging community for people living with or caring for someone who has a bleeding disorder. Visit facebook.com/bleeding disorders community today to connect with others and help take control of your bleeding disorder. Thanks for joining Natalie and I here on episode one. And please, if you haven't already, subscribe to the Bloodline podcast series on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We would also really appreciate one of those iTunes reviews. They go a long way in helping others find the series. Natalie and I also co-host a regular monthly podcast called the Bloodstream Podcast, the Bleeding Disorders Community's first professionally produced podcast series featuring a wide array of news, interviews, and informed opinionating, and distributed in partnership with the National Hemophilia Foundation. We have had great guests such as NHF CEO Val Bias, former ACA head Andy Slavitt, Family Guy actor and bleeding disorders advocate Alex Borstein, and many, many others. So if you like what you heard here, please also subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast on your podcast player of choice, or visit bloodstreammedia.com and follow the links to subscribe to all of Bloodstream Media's podcasts for the bleeding disorders community. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time,
take self-care of yourself.